Again, my ego was pretty up there. I was pretty full of myself about all these wonderful things I was doing for people. Anyway, this guy called George comes for me. He used to drink at the pub, and he said, "Oh, look, you know, he's telling me how good I am." He said, "Oh, I've got good news." He said, "My daughter's met someone in Endeavour, and they're going to get married." And I'm thinking to myself, "Why is he telling me this?" And he said, he's got tears in his eyes. I said, "What's the matter, George?" He said, "Well, his parents have got quite a bit of money, so they're going to set him up in a unit." He said, "Now I can die with not having to worry about my daughter." He said, "Because you know, people with kids with disability, that's the thing they're scared of, dying, and who's going to look after them?" And it was that moment that I changed the way I think about what I was doing. And it was more that I had the opportunity to help people because of where I was, not to beat my own chest about how good I was. And then it went on from there. And that conversation was a catalyst for a lot of change in me in regards to the way I thought about things and the reason why I wanted to do things. You know, the reason I want to do things now is to help people.
TheWellnessCouch.com, streaming wellness into your lives. Download the app today.
Welcome to the Self Love Podcast, the show that helps crack open your heart and inspire a deeper regard for your own well-being and happiness. Proudly brought to you by 28 Essentials. Here's your host, the gorgeous Kim Morrison.
Welcome to the Self Love Podcast. This week, you may need tissues. This incredible story coming at you. Gorgeous Ashley Robinson, who's a Sunshine Coast businessman and sports leader who has spent much of his life contributing to the community. He has the character, experience, and capability to always lead from the front, to offer himself and to support another human in need. This person, this amazing soul, brings 4 decades of business experience across hospitality and community service, enterprise innovations, and he has the incredible, impressive award, the Order of Australia Medal, which he received in 2016. You're going to hear what he's done. He tells his story beautifully at the beginning. There's lots of golden nuggets in here. And I especially love the fact that we got to dive deep with a man who has a past in sport, in a lot of pain and a lot of growth and a lot of giving. I just know that for any of you or know anybody that's ever had mental health issues or suffering with anything, there is so much to learn in this week's story. I really do invite you to follow Ashley Robinson here on the Sunshine Coast. And I invite your comments on my Instagram page, Kim Morrison and the number 28, on my Facebook page, Kim Morrison Training. And certainly you can head on over to the hosts of the show, thewellnesscouch.com/selflovepodcast. Thank you to 28 Essentials for sponsoring this show, but thank you wholeheartedly to Ashley for giving me his time, his energy, his story, his vulnerability, and most importantly, his integrity. I know you're going to enjoy this week's show. I cannot wait to hear what you think about it. Please let me know and make sure you follow the one and only Ashley Robinson. Take care, be kind, and I'll see you next week. One of my absolute favorite things to do each and every week is bring to the show someone who I admire, someone I look up to, and certainly someone whose story inspires me to be my best. I'd love to welcome you to the show, gorgeous Ashley Robinson.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you, Kim?
Oh, you have been doing so many interviews lately. Let's just say for the listener, this beautiful soul was one of our mayoral candidates for 2024. But that's not all you do. I would love you to take us back on your journey of what it means to you to be a Sunshine Coaster, maybe the trajectory, the past, the life that you've chosen, where you are so involved with community. Could you take us on a little journey as to where you're from, how you rose, and all the things that you're passionate about?
Yeah, sure. What do you want to know first?
Oh, everything. Just start wherever it feels right. We'll follow you on the story.
Righto. Well, I was born in Nambour but grew up in Eudlow on a pineapple farm on Robinson Road, Eudlow, which the farm my father put in about the road in about 1949. I grew up there and then we moved to Nambour when I was about 13, 14, and I went to Nambour High School, formed some great mates there at Nambour. Was a bit of a loner in some ways, had a lot of friends, but probably probably was, I think because my brother was a lot older than me, I spent a lot of time by myself. I'm on the farm, so I was used to being by myself. So when I went to Nambour, even though it doesn't sound much now, it was sort of going to, from a school of 49 kids to a school of 1,300. It was a bit daunting, and I was lucky to have good mates there, but I still kept to myself a fair bit, well, particularly mentally. So I guess I had I've always been like I'm an extrovert, an introvert, so I sort of always had this thing about I've got a good imagination, and I can tend sometimes to be a little bit, people think it's arrogant, but it's just that I'm not actually listening to them. I'm listening to the voices in my head, if it makes any sense. So, you know, Nambour, then I tried to play footy. I thought I was going to be a footy player, but I wasn't really good enough. I played all sorts of sport, water polo, cricket, represented the Sunshine Coast in a number of sports, but I wasn't much good, but I was very competitive at anything I did. I was a bit the same at school. I wasn't that bright at school, but the subjects I liked, I tried hard in. The subjects I didn't like, I didn't bother with. So hence to say, I was pretty good at English and history, and which probably the English part paid off years later when I started writing a column for the paper. But anyway, so I never really had I probably struggled a bit with females. Never really had a girlfriend, a solid girlfriend at school. Ended up a prefect at a high school, house captain, captain of the footy team, stuff like that. And then I started working. I came out of school. I wanted to be a school teacher, but I didn't apply myself as well as I should have. And I ended up just working at a sports store, playing footy. And then I got an opportunity in 1977 to go to Perth to play footy over there with a few blokes I'd played against at Maroochydore. And so I went to Perth, played for Cottesloe over there in a competition that was probably not quite as strong as the Sunshine Coast. Went pretty good over there, got picked to play for WA, broke my thumb. Then I got a bit homesick and came home about three quarters of the way through the season and picked up playing footy again at Nambour for South. And was working at the airport. I was the manager of the airport, the Maroochy Airport, which was East-West Airlines, just have one flight a day. And that was my job to make sure that the bags got off, the bags got on, the tickets got put, you know, people got loaded on the plane, made all the announcements, et cetera, et cetera. So I was doing that, broke my leg playing footy. So that finished that season. The next year I went and played for Maroochydore, which was down the road, and lived at Maroochydore, and had a lot of fun there. And then I think I just found there. But amongst all that, when I was in Perth, I got a job doing security in a nightclub because I was a big lad when I was young. And that started my passion for hospitality. Stop me anytime you like here, Kim.
No, this is good.
Started my passion for hospitality. And whilst people used to think I could fight because I looked pretty tough, I was pretty ordinary, but I was a good talker. And this nightclub I worked at in Perth, I had a couple of guys that were highly trained in jiu-jitsu, and they used to let me do the talking and they used to do the rest. And so I sort of got really interested in working in pubs. I came back to Perth and got a job at Maroochy Hotel because I was playing football for Maroochydore. So I always had two jobs. Never really found my way. And then, you know, played for Maroochydore. No, still no girlfriend. Yeah, you know, I met a few girls along the way. My brother thought I was gay because I never had a girlfriend. Then I went to, I got an opportunity to go play football out in Longreach for a year. So I went out there and worked in the shearing sheds and played footy out there. And I worked on the for the railway as well out there. And then I worked in a pub as well overnight. So everywhere I went from about 77 onwards, I always had two jobs, one during the day and one working in the pub at night. And then I come back from there and I was going to go and play footy in Stanthorpe the next year, but something happened. I ended up staying in Maroochydore and got a job. I got a temporary job at SEQEB, which is now Energex. My brother got me the job and it was semi-trailer driver. I had a semi-trailer license, but I'd never driven a semi-trailer. So I rocked up day one at Lands, where it was, and I rocked up day one with this job. We were delivering the power poles all over southeast Queensland, and they loaded this truck up with poles, and off I went in the rain in a semi-trailer that I'd never ever driven. Went over a few. How I never killed anyone is just amazing, all myself. And off I went. So I worked there. I only went there for 12 months. I was there for 8 years. Always worked in the pub of the night. Met my wife in 1983 at the Mooloolaba Surf Club, of all places. And she had a son playing footy from Maroochydore Juniors. And I was coaching a couple of junior teams, and I used to see her at training. And then I ran into her at Mooloolaba. And we ended up having a relationship, and she had two. I knew about the one that was seven, and I mustn't have been paying attention at the time when I met her, because I'd had a few beers. But when we decided to have a date, we were going to go and play squash. So I went around and picked her up and played squash, and I came back for lunch. And there's this other child who's about 13 months old, and that was Lucas. So Brendan was the older one, Lucas the younger one. So I didn't even know she had two kids. And so we ended up, just over a year later, we ended up getting married. And so I've been together for 41 years in about a week. It'll be 41 years. I've been married for 40. And the whole time still working at Energex Secret. And right about that time, the interest rates went berserk. And we'd built this house through mates of mine, good mate of mine, Brad Blank. And the block of land at Watala cost us 15 grand. And the house we put on it cost about 23. So, we're only in debt for like 30, 40 grand. But the interest rates went from like 6% to about 18%. And so we had to sell both our cars. I bought an old Telstra van, and we used to drive around that. So I used to work at Sequeb during the day and work at Mooloolaba Hotel of the night. That went on for years, trying to. So anyway, I ended up, about 1988, I got the opportunity to be the manager of the pub. The guy that was there was leaving, and I went to the owner and said, look, I reckon I've worked here for years and years and years. I reckon I could run the pub better than most of the people who've had here run it. So he gave me an opportunity. And I was just lucky enough I was at the right time. The economy was just turning, and it went really, really well. So I looked like a genius. And so that was all good for a little while. And then what happened after that was I had a guy that used to come there, and he played footy for Queensland, and he was drinking himself to death. He used to come and get the six-pack. Then it was a cask of wine. Anyway, I ended up passing away, and it had a profound effect on me. And I went home and I said to my wife one day, oh, look, I want to be a school teacher. I don't want to do this anymore. What do you mean? She goes, I said, well, I'm promoting gambling and alcohol, and I really want to do something good. She goes, well, how are you going to do that? And I said, well, I'll go to teacher's guides. I've got a good enough pass to get in there. I've had a look at it. She said, so that means you're not going to say we'll have no income for, 3 years? I went, yeah. And she said, and there's no guarantee you're going to pass because you're not that smart. And I went, yeah, well, that's a good point. And she goes, well, how are we going to pay the house off? So I had no answers to any of that. So I said, she said, well, look, I got an idea. Why don't you find something within the pub that makes you feel good, like a charity or something? And that way, you can use your position to help people. And that's probably the best piece of advice I had at that time. Apart from, I did miss something. about 3 years into our marriage, we decided we were going to have a child. And my mother, Edna, who passed away in 2012, said, I said, we're going to try and have a child. And she said, why? I said, well, I just love to, have a son. She said, you already got two, and particularly Lucas is like your own anyway. And I went, yeah. And she said, have you thought about what that will do to your relationship with Lucas? Because Brendan used to go back to his father, but Lucas had nothing to do with his father. And I went, yeah, that's a good point. She said, and A and B, you think if you had a son, it's ever going to look like he looks? And I went, yeah, that's a good point too. So we never had tried to have a child, and I haven't had any regrets for that. So anyway, back to feeling good. So I thought about that, and I never come up with any bright ideas. Anyway, one day I was working away in the pub, and there's this big, tough bricklayer called Ozzy, and he was sort of the hero of the pub. And something had happened, and he didn't like something I said, or I didn't like something he said, so he wanted to fight me. And, you know, the crowd gathered around, and, you know, they're all waiting for something to happen. And he said, well, come on. I said, well, I don't really want to fight you here, but I will fight you. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, why don't we have a fight night, and we're getting a ring and I'll fight you and we'll raise some money for charity. And he said, and he didn't really have anywhere to go with it because everyone's looking at him. And he said, yeah, right, eh? And I said, well, raise money for cerebral palsy, because one of the guys that worked, his son had cerebral palsy. So it sounded like a good idea at the time. And then we thought, well, I better put a few more fights together so that it's actually a night out. So we come up with about five fights, and we were the main event. And I had people tell me, are you sure you want to do this? Because, you know, everyone thinks you can fight, but if you actually can't fight, you're going to have some problems after this at the pub, because it's a pretty wild pub. And I went, oh, well, I just got to give it a crack. I've said I was going to do it. So Saturday arrived, and I did some training. He didn't do any training because he's pretty confident he could beat me. And about 500 or 600 people turned up to see this fight. And I got a bit nervous. And, you know, the last fight of the night, it was all pretty going pretty good. And we come out to the Rocky music and all that. Anyway, ended up calling it a draw. I knocked him down, but it was a sort of haymaker that was more like you hitting him with my forearm than punching him. But I thought I'd killed him. And so anyway, so we had a draw. So the crowd loved it. Pub made a lot of money. We made a lot of money for cerebral palsy. And all of a sudden, I had this epiphany that, hey, this is an angle for Ashley Robinson here to actually make himself feel good. So we did all sorts of things. I rode a bull for the hospital, for the children's hospital. I had another fight for cancer. I did all sorts of things. And along the way, everyone was making money out of it, and Ashley Robinson was getting a pretty good profile out of it. And one of the really bad things that happened was in 1996. A guy that I got out of school and work experience was a duty manager, and he helped me prepare for that fight. Actually, he got knifed and killed by a bikie at the pub, and that changed me. It changed the way I looked at things a lot. For a whole other bunch of levels, and in those days, I was left to deal with that a 35-year-old manager of a hotel, had to deal with a grieving family, a murder, a funeral, and everything that went with it. No support from the people I work for. But we got through it, and it probably made me a better person. So anyway, I had all these things going on. And in about 1999, the Sunshine Coast Daily rang me. Their editor-in-chief was a bloke called Peter Owen. He probably met through the election. And he rings me because I used to fight with him about, they'd always use the murder scene on the front page of the paper if something happened at Mooloolaba. So I used to ring him up and threaten him and tell him that I wouldn't advertise with him anymore, and they just kept writing what they were writing. Anyway, I get this phone call. Oh, look, we think we wouldn't mind you writing a column for the paper. I said, why? I see you're serious, you blokes. They said, yeah, well, we've never met a bloke that can turn a news story into an editorial for the, a free advertisement from Little Hotel. You're the best ever at it. So I started writing for the Sunshine Coast Daily in the end of 99. And I started on the ABC about the same time with a bloke called Cam Young and John Stokes doing sport Monday and Friday. So I had this profile that just skyrocketed, all because of entrepreneurial charity, I think you call it. But I had a pretty big head amongst it with it too, I've got to say. And then, so we're doing radio, and paper stories are going well. And I have this tipping competition with this Cam Young for the footy. And he's going to win. well, it looks like he's going to win. And he said a couple of weeks before the end, what do you want? What are you going to do if you win? What do you want me to do if you win the tipping comp? I said, oh, I want you to stand on the corner with a tutu on with a sign saying that Tugboat's the best. That's my nickname. Tugboat's the best tipper. And I said, what do you want me to do? He said, I'll tell you next week. So next week, yeah, we start talking. I'm laughing. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, well, what I want you to do is I want you to go to Nambour Special School if you lose the tipping, and I want you to spend a day with my son, Morgan, who's, you know, severely disabled. And I took the sort of fun out of the joke, and I went, yeah, yeah, I'll do that. So anyway, needless to say, he won the tipping thing. And so I go to the Nambour School, followed by the daily and the radio for a day, working with the teachers. And it was a really, you know, it was one of those moments where you realise how lucky you are. Anyway, I'm talking to the teachers and the principal's telling me that they haven't got enough money for their school trip away for their seniors. Now, the ignorance of me about people with disabilities at that age stage was I didn't realise that kids at special schools had a trip away for a start. So I said, you know, to the media, well, I've got to find a way to raise the money for it. So I had all these people ringing me and all different ideas. I really had no idea what I was going to do. So that was 2000. So anyway, Bill Hoffman, who was one of the editors of the paper, rang me about something and told me him and funnily enough, Jason O'Pray were going to swim around Old and Island from Majimba for a bit of fun. And I said, well, hang on, Billy, why don't we swim from Majimba to Mooloolaba, around the island and go to Mooloolaba, and we'll see if we can raise some money for this school. And he said, yeah, that's not a bad idea. And I said, well, I'll get the sponsorship and you do the, you know, you do the media for it. So the theme was, because Billy and I were not that popular, let me tell you, was that, you know, people are throwing money out going, well, I'll give you $500 if you get wet. I'll give you $1,000 if you don't make it, or you get attacked by a shark and die. So we got a lot of interest in it. It got put off a couple of times because of weather, and everyone thought we weren't going to do it. But we eventually did it on this rainy, windy, choppy day because we couldn't keep cancelling. I nearly bloody drowned, but we got there and we raised $39,500 for the school. So we bought them a bus. So we bought them this bus, and they wanted to put our photos on the side of the bus, and we said people just throw bottles at it, so don't do that. So anyway. So when they get their bus delivered, the principal says, well, what are you going to do next year now? And you go, what do you mean? He goes, well, you're going to do it every year. So everyone knows we can do it. That's why we raised the money, because they thought we'd either die or wouldn't make it. So I came up with the idea of people paying money to go and do it, whether they were a single swimmer or a relay. So it really took off, and wish lists were involved for the first year, the first couple of years. Then we got Curramundi School, and then it ended up Curramundi and Nambour School. Now it's all the special schools. But so we raised a lot of money. I mean, next year was like $95,000, thanks to people like Caroline Hutchison. And she did the swim. So I did it probably about 12 or 13 times in a row by myself. It's 11 kilometres. And when you're, and the theme was always for some people, the swimming's easy and the fundraising's hard. The other one, and the opposite. The fundraising was easy for me, but the swimming was hard. So anyway, about the third year, or maybe fourth year, again, my ego was pretty up there. I was pretty full of myself about all these wonderful things I was doing for people. Anyway, this guy called George came and saw me. He used to drink at the pub, and he said, oh, look, you know, he's telling me how good I am. He said, oh, I've got good news. He said, my daughter's met someone in Endeavour, and they're going to get married. And I'm thinking to myself, why is he telling me this? And he said, and he's got tears in his eyes. I said, what's the matter, George? He said, well, his parents have got quite a bit of money, so they're going to set him up in a unit. He said, now I can die with not having to worry about my daughter. He said, because, you know, people with kids with disability, that's the thing they're scared of, dying, and who's going to look after them. And it was that moment that I changed the way I think about what I was doing. And it was more that I had the opportunity to help people because of where I was, not to beat my own chest about how good I was. And then it went on from there, and that conversation was a catalyst for a lot of change in me in regards to the way I thought about things and the reason why I wanted to do things. You know, the reason I want to do things now is to help people, but also you get more out than you put in, because it's like, you know, you give something to someone, you get more out of it than they get, I think. But one of the great things about what I've been able to do, thanks to a wonderful network of people I got, is it raises the profile of different things, where someone sees me doing something that might raise 10 grand, all of a sudden they get involved in that charity because they think it's a good thing and it's worth a lot more than 10 grand then. But I guess one other thing I should recap on is at about the age of 19, all my mates had had girlfriends, some of them already married actually. I was single. I had some mental health problems. And I think I was living with my parents at this stage. So I'd either gone to Perth and come back or whatever. I felt like a real loser. I was playing pretty good footy. And I was always the life of the party. But when I was at home by myself, I was pretty in a pretty bad place. And it got worse and worse and worse till one night I got my dad's shotgun out of the cupboard and was going to pull a trigger, but I just couldn't do it. I just thought, what a bloody mess I'm going to make here for my mother. And I didn't do it. And then that happened twice. And then I managed to put it all behind me. I still used to have days where right up until, 2010 or 11, I'd have days where I just didn't want to see anyone, didn't want to talk to anyone. And I'd had a commitment. Sometimes the people ask me to MC something, and I just, as it got closer, I didn't want to do it because it'd be a little trigger. It'd be, oh, so-and-so's going to be there and they don't like me or whatever. And I'd get right to the death and I'd try and make an excuse to get out of it. So I'd sort of battle with that. But I'd put the suicide stuff way behind me. And then when I got the job at the surf club in 2010, I had some really good jobs. I had some great jobs, paying great money. Worked for Reed Hospitality. We built an orphanage in India. That helped my mental health immensely because I went over to India 6 times and realized why should I be worried? These people are happy and they've got zero going on for them. So that was helpful and it made me feel good. It was a great project. But I was always paid well, but I still used to have these moments where I'd be driving along sometimes and see a cement truck coming the other way and go, maybe I just pull into that and it's all over. In 2000, I can't remember, early 2012, something like that, had a cleaner at the surf club and he'd had some mental health problems. I tried to help him with him and I ended up giving up. And I said, if he didn't turn up for work, I'd just do what he was going to do. And anyway, he went missing, and one of the ladies in the office said, I haven't seen so-and-so for a while. He's supposed to be here for 2 days. I haven't been here. And I went into the cleaner's room, and his phone was there, and his keys were there. And I thought, this doesn't look good. So I got his address, and I went round there. And I knocked at the door, no answer. It was at his mother's place, no answer. Anyway, I went to leave, and the roller door was up a little bit. So I lifted the roller door up. It was the middle of summer. It was the 2 days before Australia Day. And I could smell something. And I thought, this can't be good. So I've gone and I've looked up the stairs. And the first thing I'll remember this till I die, was the ladder from work. I thought, what's he doing with my ladder here? And then I've looked up and he'd hung himself. So I was pretty calm. I rang the police and I rang the ambulance, which wasn't really needed, but I rang the president of the surf club and told him what had happened. And I said, I'll wait here for the authorities to get here. But what that actually did, that actually brought back my sort of stuff after it. I started thinking, I'd sort of conveniently forgotten about what I was going to do. And the more I researched what had happened to this guy, they said he was the day the lifeguards had seen him before he did it, he was the happiest they'd ever seen him. So obviously he'd made his decision. But that really, really took its toll on me. And then probably about 12 months, well, we had a memorial service for him. And I remember his mum and dad, his mum and his sister came and saw him and said, we believe you, you're doing a bit tough because of what happened, but don't worry, it was always going to happen. This was always how it was going to end. So you couldn't have stopped it, but it didn't make me feel any better. And then about, maybe a year later, I go off play footy with the same thing. And, it brought back some shit feelings I had. So anyway, I don't know why I told you that, but I think it all sort of makes up the fabric of people. So roll the clock forward to about 2000. I'm going okay. I'm still going okay. I'm managing. I used to do a lot of meditating. I had a couple of mates of martial artists that used to get me meditating and so that I, could stay positive. And I'd had some positive things happen to me, but, every now and then I'd regress to that. Anyway, digress to that. So anyway, 2018, Brendan, the oldest bloke, had a drug issue his whole life when he was about 15. I think it possibly to do to his mother getting divorced. Not sure, but he's living in Bali, working in Bali. He's a functioning drug addict. He gets caught with cocaine over there. And I get the phone call. I get the phone call from one of his mates' mothers saying, "Hey, this is what's happened." So, and he's, he's going to get the firing squad if you don't get over here. So I ring his brother and I go, "Hey, I'll meet you at home because this is what's happened. We got to tell your mother." So went home, told her. Obviously, she was angry for a start and then devastated. And so I had a couple of police mates. So I told them what had happened, and they gave me this guy to ring who had got Chappelle Corby out of jail over there. A bloke, let's just call him John. And anyway, I rang him, and he said, "Well, it hasn't hit the media yet." I went, "No." He said, "Well, we need to get a Bali. We go on Saturday." So this was about Wednesday. Anyway, in the meantime, the media get a sniff of it. They figured out, the girl from Channel 7 put two and two together and figured out it was a connection to me. So John McLeod, his name was, he didn't want me to talk to the media. I said, "Mate, I've got to because I cannot leave my wife here with this. So I've got to deal with it." So I rang the chick. I said, "Let's have a news conference up at the top of the bluff." And I said, "If you want to organise the other media outlets, I'll do this in one hit." So anyway, I'm walking up to there's two things that happen. I'm walking up this media thing and a certain federal member rings me and tells me that he can't help me. And I said, "Listen, I didn't remember asking you for help, mate. This is something we've got to deal with." I'll never forget that conversation. Then the other one was from this John McLeod. And he said, "If you're going to do this, I want you to do me one favour." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Thank the Indonesian officials for looking after Brendan. Can you do that?" I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "Well, I just want you to do it." So I get up there, have the media thing, and that's what I did. And I said, I just want to thank him. Brendan's had the drug issues. I've always expected this phone call. He's had drug issues his whole life. But I do want to thank the Indonesian officials for looking after him. So then we go over there. It's a bit of to and fro for the first week. And then it gets down to the nitty gritty with firing squad, 20 years, 10 years, 5 years and 4 months is the best he can do, which we ended up negotiating after probably 9 months of me going back and forward to Bali. When I first got there, he was still in jail. Then he got moved to a prison, a Karakaban prison. Absolutely zero help from the embassy. I didn't ask him for money, but a bit of compassion would have been really, really good, but we didn't get anything. They did what they had to do. They tick and flick. They'd go and visit him, say, "Yeah, he's fine. That's it." So we ended up getting the best result we could possibly get. So he does his time. The Balinese media were very good to me because we weren't those typical Australians going, "It's corrupt. He didn't do it, blah, blah, blah." He had to, when he got his sentence, they tried to get me to ask me whether I was happy with the sentence. I said, "Yeah, of course I am. He's got to pay the price for what he's done, and that's the price." And, we all paid it. I paid it. He paid it. His mother paid it. His brother paid it. So he does his time. He gets out. He's home. He's a completely different human being. He has no issues anymore with anything, and it actually made us as a family a whole lot stronger. And then when I get home after his sentencing, not so much at the end, but then his mother tells me that she's got cancer, but she didn't want to tell me while while I was going through what I was going through with him. So we get through that. Nancy falls off a motorbike and nearly loses a leg. We get through that. And, you know, then he gets out. And I'm got to tell you, as a family, all those things made us better people. Do I have any mental health issues anymore? Not one. I realise how lucky we are, and I realise through it all that the only thing that's really important is your family and your friends. It doesn't matter what sort of car you got, doesn't matter what sort of house you live in. It's just your family, your friends, and your health. They're the only things that are important. And I guess that's been the message since Brennan got out of jail, and it's been the best thing to happen to me. Apart from coming to the Alex Surf Club in 2010, I was lucky enough to be offered the job. I didn't apply for it. I was offered the job, and I took it, and I've had 14 years here. They were superb through the Bali stuff and superb through COVID. And it's easily the most rewarding job I've ever had. And just as we speak, I finished here this week because I feel like I need to go and do something different. And as I said, it's been the most rewarding nearly 14 years of my life in regard to my work life. So that is Ashley Robinson's story.
Oh, I tell you what, I've been holding on to every word. There is something incredibly raw and real and authentic and amazing about you. And I just first of all want to commend you and thank you for being one of the men that did crawl through what he was going through, but also managed to come out the other side. And one of the biggest things that I've taken away from your story is just mental health is a massive issue. I know it's a lot and very strong for a lot of men, particularly young men. And I know a lot of women go through different mental health issues. In your humble opinion, as you reflect on telling your story, I know that everything has made you into what you are today. But do you think there's enough help? Do you think there's a different course? What do you think is contributing so much to the high statistics of suicide, particularly in Australia and New Zealand? And if there was anything you could advise or do, what would that be?
Well, I think that one of the things that, you know, I've been an advocate for men's mental health for a long time and disability, because I think we all take advantage, you know, take it as, you know, we take our health and everything too easily. When I had a mate, his son jumped off the thing down in Sydney, off the headland in Sydney, and I went to the funeral, and there was about 400 people at South Kirkhill Surf Club, and his uncle got up because the father couldn't speak. The uncle got up, and I think this is the best analogy for mental health is, you know, Toby said to me one day that, you know, if I broke my leg and I ran in a marathon with a broken leg, people would be standing and applauding me. He said, mental health is a marathon, but no one can see it and no one's applauding. And I think that is, that's so real that we don't, you know, it's the old, you know, go to the fridge and get a can of toughen, you know, toughen up. I think that, you know, I think opinions have changed, but there's certainly not enough support for it. I just think also, I think we're too tied up in material possessions and stature in the community, as in social stature. You know, you've got all these influences and all that around the place, and I'm sure that affects other people who think they're failures. Like we had a thing here at the surf club where some people were getting bullied on Facebook, and I told them that story about the shotgun, which absolutely shocked the parents and the kids. And I said, you know what? I thought I was a loser. If I would have seen it in print, as in Facebook, I probably would have pulled the trigger, you know, there was, to me, whatever you put on Facebook or whatever, you know, it's there for people to see. I think that, but we are way too tied up in what success is. And somehow we've got to break that cycle with people and go, well, you know, success has just been a good human. Like it's helping someone or success shouldn't be measured by how important you think you are or how important or how unimportant other people think you are. It should be, you know, we need to help people with their with what's inside and with their soul. I there was an analogy years ago where, you know, if you stood on the, if you think about things and you, let's say you're looking down from above, whether it's heaven or whatever you want to, and there's a crossroad and you're going to turn left to kill yourself. You're going to turn right and you're going to have a few windy, bumpy bits, but you're going to turn right. And, you know, so many people need to turn right. They need to look at that and go, hang on. There's no hope if it's left. But if I go right, I might have to go up a few mountains. But at the end of the day, I've still got a chance of getting to where I want to get. But it's where they want to get is the issue. I think we're too material. There's too many people thinking they're just too cool for school that affects other people as well. I just think it's got to be more of an art. Look, we had a breakfast here years ago for mental health breakfast. I told my mental health story, and the man or women came up to me and said, "If I just wish my father would have been here to hear you talk about that." And I think that's the important thing. We've got to talk about it, but you've got to be able to crack. You know, it's like the "Are you okay, Dave?" Well, that's okay. That's great. But what happens? What happens when you ask someone, "Are you okay?" And go, "No, actually, I'm not." What's the next step? You know what I mean? That's the important part, what that next step is. And a lot of the people going around asking people, "Are you okay?" I don't know what the next step is if they get a negative answer. And that's one of the things we've got to fill, I believe.
That was a question I was going to say to you, though, because, yes, Are You Okay Day and Grab Life by the Balls and all these beautiful men's charitable groups that are out there, and wonderful, absolutely phenomenal. They get the conversation started. And I'm sure people like Grab Life by the Balls, these guys have seen this enough. That's a charity here on the Sunshine Coast. I'm just curious to ask you then, as someone who's experienced this, and I too witnessed my own husband go through many dark moments after losing his sister to suicide and also losing his status as an international cricketer, which I find fascinating how sport can be such a saviour, but when it's over kind of thing. What do we say to someone? What is the point? How do we support someone when we say, "You're okay," and they go, "Not really," or "I'm struggling"?
I probably haven't got the answer to that either, but we've got to find the answer. And all these, you know, all these people with goodwill and good intentions, but we need to, you know, if it was me, if I'm asking that question, you know, the first thing I'm going to do is to talk to those people about, you know, well, tell me why you're feeling like that. Like, you tell me why you're feeling like that. And again, we've got to go down that road of, hey, you know, you can't be judging. Don't worry about other people judging you. Like, you judge, I think, you know, you should be judged by yourself, as in, if you're too hard on yourself, well, why are you too hard on yourself? And try and bring some reality into that conversation to go, well, actually, you know, you've done this or you've done that, and this, you know, like there's got to be, you've got to unravel it somehow. You know, I never went on medication because I think all medication does is just cover the problem. But I'm not saying as an expert that you shouldn't go on medication, because if the doctor puts you on, that's what you should be on. But I just chose not to. But I found meditation the greatest thing for me. And even in Bali, I had a anxiety attack in this shop right when all this was going on, and that John McLeod dragged me out of the shop and said, "Right, we're going for a walk." And we walked about 15 kilometres and we ended up in this temple. And I remember sitting there going, well, this is as good a time as anyone to meditate and breathe. And the meditation, I think, is the greatest thing for mental health. You know, obviously it's different strokes for different folks, but exercise and meditation certainly brings things back into perspective.
I think too, like, and I'm going to be open and honest here with you, Ash, you know, many years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, probably no longer, I would have thought suicide was a selfish act. I wouldn't have thought about what the person was going through. I just would have, I felt so much for the people left behind. Since losing Danny's sister and since going down that whole pathway over the last 19 years and really working on this together with my husband and our family as a whole, you know, it's from an esoteric metaphysical point of view, it's way bigger than just a selfish act. That person, it was described to me like you're looking up, the light gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it's a pinprick. That's how they feel. I'm not sure that's for everybody, but I'm just curious, in your instance, when you mentioned that gentleman that the mother came up to you and said it was always going to happen, do you believe in generational trauma or carrying the pains of our past, that sometimes we are chosen and it's chosen for us? And I know that's a really weird question, but I'm just curious because you are interested in the meditation side.
Yeah, look, I do, but I think somehow you've got to brush that past off and go, well, this is, you know, this I'm an individual and this is me. But it's easy for us to say that. But again, I think, you know, and I always say, my wife, people talk about, because I write columns about her and call her old mate, and I put a bit of shit on her from time to time. I was lost and then I was found. If I wouldn't have found her, I'd say we wouldn't be having this conversation today. So my thing was, I just felt like a loser because I was pretty good, you know, work-wise, but socially and as far as a relationship, I was hopeless. But you got to somehow. So I probably can't answer that question of yours because I think I would have been a statistic if it wasn't for her, if it wasn't for Sheila, and it wasn't for Lucas and Brennan to that point. My dad died when I was 25. I cannot remember the last conversation I had with my father, and I cannot remember any intimate conversation I ever had with him ever. And that wasn't his fault. You know, his ex-army farmer, that was just the way it was. Yeah. But I think if there's one thing we've all learned, and I've tried to do it with Brendan and Lucas, is, you know, I remember when I was going through a bit of a tough time and I was going to a psychologist, and she said, well, you know, what sort of parent do you think you've been? I said, well, I'm not sure. Why don't you ask Lucas what sort of parent you've been and what you could have done better? And we're playing golf and one of my balls obviously went into the bush and we're sitting there waiting to play the shot. Someone was in front of us and we're both looking ahead and I thought, well, and he's not a very emotional kid, Lucas. So I asked him the question. I said, listen, if, you know, there's an exercise I've got to do for what I'm going through. I just want to know what I could have done better as a parent. And there was this silence, but like this uncomfortable silence for probably a minute. And he said, I couldn't think about it. You could have done better, you know? And I think that's you've got to get close. You know, you've got to get close to the emotions of your family or your friends to find out what is bothering them and what's good and what's bad, you know, because it's not all bloody beer and roses, you know?
Yeah. Another fascinating point I want to bring up with you, because it has been your world for so long and it's certainly been my world, is the whole metaphor of life around sport. Sport is one of the most incredible connectors. It's socially bringing people together. It's powerful. It's the win, the lose. It's coping with the wins, coping with the losses. When we have someone we love out there in the middle of the cauldron, out there doing their job, and someone flings words or abuse, their armchair critics and all of this sort of thing, when a player's at the top of their game, and I'm talking top international, you know, league players because of what I've been through, it's great. Everyone's chanting their name. But as Danny, my husband's always said, you know, opinions are like arseholes. Everybody's got one. But it takes a certain type after a while not to take that personally. I remember watching Chris Kenn's playing out in the middle at the Wacker one day, and he'd just lost his sister something like 14 days beforehand in a train accident. And these guys were hurtling abuse because he got hit for six and hit for another six. And they were just sitting there drinking their beers, innocently really, just yelling out abuse. But I turned around and gave it to them and just said, what would it take for you to be out there losing your sister, you know, 2 weeks ago? And to be fair, they shut up. I don't know if that was out of kindness or just out of, geez, who's this nutcase? But there is an element of people like us that are in sport that do want to protect these guys. The minute you're not wanted or needed in a team, or you've got too old, or you're injured, or having mental health issues, or whatever it is, you're kind of almost thrown onto the junk heap of life. Is sport an oxymoron for mental health? It's good for you, but it also cannot be good for you. What do you think's the answer in that sporting world? How do we look after our athletes as they're coming up? And also when they finish their careers, some of them finish their careers before they're even 30.
I think, if I can speak on a rugby league scope, I think they're learning slowly that, you know, the thing is they're told what to do. The problem is, and it's probably Danny as well, that they're on an escalator to the top, and everyone's telling them how good they are at school, and you know their parents are telling them they're good, and then they end up, you know, reaching the highest level, and everyone's telling them they're good, and they tell them what to eat, they tell them what to train, they tell them where to be, and they tell them what to wear, and then it all stops, for all sorts of reasons, and then all of a sudden, you know, unless you're, you know, outstanding, unless you're a superstar, all of a sudden everyone forgets you. And obviously then half of them don't know how to operate. They go, well, what do I do now? And I think sport's getting better at it than it was, NRL and things like that and rugby union. But, yeah, they've got to learn how to live, haven't they? They've got to learn. And that's what annoys me. One of the things that really annoys me is state of origin. And I've never, you know, I shouldn't really be commenting because I was average at everything I did. But one of the things that annoys me, and I try and say to the guys that play for the Falcons, you know, if shit doesn't go your way and, you know, the game's over, don't sit in the ground. And I say it at the surf club too with kids. You know, don't go crying about getting beaten, not in front of the person that beat you. Go and dive in the water and have a cry there, but shake hands on them and look them in the eye and tell them well done, but use it as a motivation for the next time, because there's a couple of reasons why I hate seeing people sit on the ground. Is one, it gives the people that beat them a whole lot more joy than they deserve. And two, life is dead set about how tough you can be, how you can take the knocks and get up and keep going. There's lots of things that aren't fair in life. You know, I've been through that bloody election. I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done that election and feel the way I feel now, which I feel great, if it wasn't for what had happened to me over the last probably 20 years, like particularly probably the last 10 years that made me strong mentally. Now, you know, people saying shit about me, I couldn't care less. Like, I could not care less. 15 or 20 years ago, I would have been in a fetal position in a corner somewhere. But I've been managed to be able to conquer that by things that have happened to me and by the fact I survived. Because I had good people around me. And that's what we need to get around people, good people. I use Alfie Langer as an example. You know, Alfie is a superstar, but sometimes I feel that the group around him after he played football wasn't the best influence on him. You know what I mean? Like, I always think that, you know, I don't know how to put it. You need to bring people to reality, say, hey, this bit's over, and what are we doing now? And it needs brave people, brave friends to say that sometimes to people, because, you know, they go, well, you know, because the gravy train stops eventually, and someone's paying somewhere for everything, and then when they stop paying, you know, you got to go and find something else to do.
Yeah. You know, I wrote a book about it because I watched my son go through some pretty tough times, and having been a part of it in our family, the experiences we've been through. And I kept trying to think, how do you tell people to care for themselves, love themselves, believe in themselves? And being an athlete myself, I like a pathway. And I've always felt that the first step is always being aware that you're going through a tough time, aware that life sucks right now, aware that it's not all going your way. And then the next step I've always felt was to care for yourself. Look after yourself. Don't go drinking it into oblivion, or, as you say, sitting in the middle of the cauldron with that, feeling sorry for yourself. It's that real eating well, looking after yourself, getting on, picking yourself up, and if nothing else, looking out for someone else, serving someone else. Third step was self-discipline. Like, there's an element of discipline in being a good human. Would you agree with me on that, and the fact that it takes time and effort? You don't just do it once and think that you're fine. Is that a fair comment from your point of view?
Oh, look, very fair, and I'll relate back to some of the rhetoric in this mayoral campaign that I've listened to, and I think to myself, up until the day that George told me about his daughter, I probably was a chess beater. From that day onwards, I certainly haven't been. I've tried to you know, I don't like going away parties. I don't like when someone will say, can you emcee this thing for me? I go, yeah, I'll do it, but do me one favor. Don't give me a gift at the end of the day and don't introduce me. I'll introduce myself because I hate all that now. And I think, you know, you've got to, I just think you've got to look towards others. As I said at the start, the more you do for people, the better you feel. So if you're feeling shit house, go and do something for somebody else. Now, it could be a homeless person. Go and give them $10, or if you haven't got $10, go and give them something to keep them warm. Go and give something, and let me tell you, everywhere you go, there's someone worse off than you. And that was the trip to India that was what snapped me half out of it. Was there's these guys riding around the pushbike with a sheet of corrugated iron on the back of their thing to make somewhere to sleep, all with a smile on their face. That, yeah, the world, yeah, it doesn't matter what you got. But go, if you're feeling shit house, go on, I can help someone else and it'll make you feel better. I guarantee you.
Yeah. And I think we forget how lucky we are in this place, in this beautiful country that we all live in. I feel we underestimate the incredible gifts that we have here. I just want to pay homage to your two sons and to your gorgeous wife. You're talking about having a good crew around you. They too would have been feeling your pains, your anguish, your suffering, and vice versa. That's the beauty and the sadness of family. We feel for each other. If there was one thing that you would say to Sheila this day and age, I'm sure you say it all the time, but what is the thing that you would say to the people that have helped you the most right now?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Excuse me. Well, as I said, I wouldn't be. So I think it's just thanks for thanks for their resilience, I guess is what I'd say. Thanks for hanging in there with me. I guess, yeah, the thing about where I'm at right now, out of a job, not the mayor, is I've never felt better, apart from having a sore back at the moment. I've never felt so, I guess, free. I've always been wanting to help, and I've got a couple of little projects I've got out of that candidacy, out of running for mayor, that I'm going to help people with, that I promised I would, whether I was mayor or not. But yeah, I just want to thank. There's a lot of people that show a lot of resilience for me. Obviously, my family, but a lot of other people as well.
It's incredible. I think I asked you the question earlier, what do we say to someone when we ask if they're okay and they say, I'm not good? I think you just answered it. Being able to thank that person for their resilience, honour them for that, but then hang in there with them. That's probably the biggest key of all. You don't have to solve any problems. It's just making people feel like there's someone there. What is your definition of self-love?
I don't really know. I guess, look, I think if I add all things up, I used to go to sleep when I was younger, go to sleep wishing I was famous, wishing I was a NRL footy player, wishing I was a test cricketer. Then I used to go to sleep wishing I won lotto, 40 million or something like that, wishing I was important or I was rich. Now I go to sleep wishing I win 40 million so I could give half it away. I think my self-love is, I am dead set, I guess, focused on helping other people because it helps me. So that's my self-love.
I love it so much. You are an absolute delight. I just love talking to you. I can't believe you thought I was cold when you first met me. I'm just a little bit shocked.
I understand.
It's so funny because
always to take a step. Well, you see what? Actually, a psychologist guy that used to see us down the beach used to always laugh. And he told me this years later, we'd be walking the dog, and I'd be with my wife, and he'd pull up and start talking to us, and I'd take a step back and let them do the talking. And he said to me, "Why do you do that? Why?" I said, "I didn't even know I did it, but it's just a habit." My thing was, for a long time, I get paid to talk to people when I'm talking down the beach. No one's paying me, so I'll let them do the talk and I'll just do the listening. But yeah, I think you're a bit like that. I think you just see two blokes. And that's the other thing, I guess, that people mistake me for. They look at me, they look at, I've had a hard life. I'm a, I look like I'm a yobbo, but I'm not, but I look like I am. I'm a simple sort of person. Like, I've got simple, you know, I've got a simple outlook on life. I don't tell lies. Unfortunately, if people ask me my opinion, I'll tell them whether it's going to upset them or not. I haven't got that filter. If someone asks me, what do you think of my haircut? I'll tell them what I think of it, when I could just say, yeah, no, that's great, but I can't do that. So I guess with you, I just thought, oh, you know, that's that bloody Kim Morrison. She's up the social scale from Ashley Robinson and Watala. So that's probably what I thought. But it didn't bother me. I just put it down to, you know, and let me tell you, I've met a lot of those people in the last 12 weeks. I think you're high up the social scale, and it doesn't really bother me. But to be fair to you, you know, the day I chased you across the park with the flyer, with men's flyer, I think you're a wonderful, wonderful, warm human being.
Oh, well, it's funny because it's an interesting thing, this whole human connection, relationships and all the senses and how we misread or miscommunicate things. I always thought, poor Dan, he never has much to, you know, many people to catch up with because he's not home very much. So whenever he saw you, I thought, Kim, just butt out, stop, right. Let the two boys talk. So isn't it interesting? Right. Now, just before, I know we could talk forever, but just, you know, the mayoral campaign, it was pretty big here on the coast. First time, I'll be honest with you, Ash, I've been interested in politics because I knew three of you going for the candidacy. And I got to really study human nature, being on the polling booths, handing out things, wanting people to just feel good and vote for who they believed in. And first time I got really a little bit passionate about and excited for each and every one of you. I watched you talk to so many souls. The way tradies, footy players, men, women, children would come up to you with the biggest beaming smile. I can honestly say you have made a massive difference, and you've only just been behind our winning mayoral candidate. You shook it all up. You really did raise the bar as far as what it means to be human, in my humble opinion. And I just want to publicly thank you for being the man that you are, for looking out for other people, for not doing a dirty campaign or putting other people down. You really fought the good fight. And I just want to ask you, what was the biggest learning you took away from a mayoral campaign, and what does it mean to you? I know now you're good, but what has it actually gifted to you?
Well, I guess going into it, I didn't want to embarrass myself, I suppose. I thought, what if no one bloody votes for me? So I guess that was a little bit of thought. Well, you know, I pushed myself into it because, you know, as I said before, I've been writing a column for the paper for years and years and years, and I've been very critical of politicians. And I thought, well, you know, here's an opportunity not to be a politician. Let's be a community member and see how you go. And I was comfortable with getting criticised because I've never got personal with people, but I've criticised people. And obviously the only person I criticised through this campaign was Jason O'Pray. I left the two girls alone because I thought I already looked like a bully. The last thing I need to be doing is trying to bully those girls. And I must say, both of them, like, I really warmed the men during the campaign, and Wayne, the guy from Montville, and Rosanna, whilst we don't have the same, I guess we've got completely different views on things, but I have to give her a massive credit for the way tenacious, hard work, and the way she did it, the way she, you know, her ground forces on that polling day were unbelievable. Whereas, you know, men's and mine were our friends and our family, and who we could get to talk them into doing it. So, you know, that's where she won it, right? That's where Rosanna won on that Saturday. And that's not a criticism of our volunteers, because I wouldn't have wanted to do it any other way. You know, that was just the way it was. I've been a little bit disappointed with the untruths around the campaign. I was pretty disappointed with the mayor and Andrew Wallace telling people that I was in the Labor Party. And that only encouraged me, the fact that I must have been going all right. Leading up to it, I thought I always thought that Jason was going to win when I first started. But by the time we got the second week of pre-poll, I could see it was Rosanna and me, and I'm thinking, I'm a chance here. I've probably got no regrets. What I got out of it was pretty simple. I was surprised how many people actually supported me. I was surprised the offers of help from people that I didn't even know. probably the highlight, I don't know whether you witnessed it, was two kids from the Kuramani Special School kind of vote. And on the same day, didn't know each other. They were about 3 or 4 minutes apart. And both had carers with them. One was called Matthew. I don't know the other guy's kid's name, but Matthew come and give me a big hug and told me he's voting for me. And then the other young bloke, he was probably 30 with his care. His carer told me she was going to vote for me because she saw me as a fairy godmother in a pantomime years ago. And she said, anyone that can do that can be the mayor. So I sort of started laughing. And then the kid had basically ignored me till then. And he turned around, just hugged me and just said, Tugboat, I'm voting for you. They were the two highlights for me.
Well, it was certainly beautiful to watch. And you were awarded the Order of the Australia Medal in 2016 for your community service. I know accolades like that don't mean a lot to you as far as you don't do it for that. But did that have some sort of beautiful recognition for the things that you do, and did it inspire you to keep doing what you're doing?
Oh, look, I was a bit embarrassed about that. I you know, people nominated me. It's like, you know, some really good hearted people nominate. I didn't know anything about it until I got a letter from Government House to say, would I accept it? And because I've always been that guy that's been in the right place at the right time to help people, you know. But I must say, when we actually went to Government House, and I didn't even want to go, to be honest with you, but when we went there, there was my wife, my sister and my daughter-in-law Chloe, my son Lucas, because Brendan was in Bali, and Bridget Seymour, who's a kid from the surf club here that, you know, I'm part of her growing up. So I could invite four people, so I invited her. And I've still got the photo. It was on my desk until I cleaned it out yesterday of her and me. And it was nice. It was, but probably the nice part about it was to see what other people getting awards. There was bravery awards. There was all sorts of awards on the day. And it was nice to see what wonderful people there are out there. I guess I've never used that OAM title. And the only time I'd use it was if I wrote a reference to someone when they'd ask me, or a character reference. But I was advised to use it for the mayoral campaign, and I probably wouldn't have. But I did, and you know, the genie's out of the bottle, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, look, it was a nice reward, but something that I probably wasn't looking for.
No, I can't imagine that for you. But I don't know if we could ever create an award that would encompass and acknowledge everything that you give and do. And I know there's lots of amazing humans like yourself out there giving of themselves. This podcast is my way of giving back to the community, sharing people's amazing stories and taking the time to actually listen to their story. I love interviewing people. I love hearing where they're from. And I think you even said I was a psychologist on the side of the polling booth. You were wondering where I was going with my questions. I was just betting you for this podcast. I mean, what man with a big league and hard background that you've had would come on to the Self Love podcast? How could I not have you on?
Oh, well, you did psychoanalyze me at the polling booth, that's for sure. But you know, funnily enough, I'm pretty open to that. Look, if it's in the right spot at the right time, I'm happy to share whatever. A bit like Kramer out of Seinfeld, I'll tell you how I'm feeling, whether it's good or bad, because, you know, I think it's good for you. I think it's good for your mental health to actually talk about uncomfortable things sometimes, or you know, I don't like hearing people blow their own trumpet, but it is nice to talk about your experiences and your life experiences and the way you feel. And I think that's that. And going back to your question earlier on, you know, as a parent or as a friend of someone that has got some issues, you know, you gotta listen to how they're feeling, and you gotta try and dig in there and find out how they are really feeling, and try and support them. And you cracked through me straight away at that polling booth. Some people, you know, I no good at parties. You know, when you go to a party. And I don't go to parties anymore, but when we used to, and you get some knucklehead that sort of wants to talk to you, but they're really, you know, they want to know what you do, how important you are, or who you are, but really all they want to do is tell you how important they are. I've sort of got this defense mechanism that goes, well, I'll give them short answers so that they just go away and talk to someone else, because I've got enough friends. I've got enough people I love. I don't need any more unless they do. If they crack through that, well and good. But it's sort of a subconscious thing. You crack through it pretty easy, I've got to say.
It was such a delight to do that. I know we could keep going. I know you've got other things to do. But what I'd love to just finish with is, could you first of all start off by telling us how you got the nickname Tugboat, and then maybe finish up with, the self-love podcast listener is someone who really does enjoy listening to other people's stories. They love hearing. I guess in many ways, we're each our own hero in our own journey. We all go through different adventures in life. We come up against challenges. We find mentors or beautiful things to do to support us. And we come out the other side of these experiences, probably a much bigger, better human for it. If you could finish with a quote and your message to the self-love podcast listener, we'd be very, very grateful. But perhaps start off with, where did Tugboat come from?
Well, I was playing footy for Maroochydore, and it was raining, it was muddy. And I was a scrum, and I was always the last. I was the front rower, and I was always the last of the scrum. So the rest of them were all standing there, both teams are standing there waiting for me. Just a lock forward, who was a car salesman, a bit of a smart ass. And he said, "Come on, Tugboat, will you hurry up? For God's sake, hurry up." And I've gone, "What?" And then one of the opposition players, what's with the Tugboat thing? And he goes, "Oh, slow and steady. Can rely on him, but he's slow and steady." And everyone started laughing, including both forward packs, and they just stuck. But it actually went away until about 1999, when I started doing the media stuff, and John Stokes, the great John Stokes, who's passed away now from the ABC, and Cam Young both resurrected the nickname. And I didn't have it for probably 10 years, and then it came back about 99. I've had it ever since. And you know what? I actually don't mind it. It's not a bad nickname.
I love it. Love the meaning.
I guess my thing is, if I had a saying, and I heard a great AFL player said it when he was put in the Hall of Fame and he was dying of cancer, and he said, "It's nice to be important, but it's far more important to be nice." I think that's sort of the mantra we all should be. And I guess if I had a message to you, listeners, is, you know, the slow and steady thing, the Tugboat thing, it's, life isn't easy. Sometimes you take a step forward and you get knocked back a step and a half. You just got to keep taking that step forward and good things will happen. And as I've always said, if you give 20% of your time and your money to other people, you get it back tenfold. And that's been my theory. So thank you.
Oh, Ash, you're an incredible human. I thank you so much for not keeping me in that cold space anymore. I do consider you a friend, whether you wanted a new one or not. I'm just around the corner from you, and I will be knocking on your door, just saying. I want to thank you wholeheartedly for being on my show and for everything you gave over the last month, 2 months, and also everything else you do in the community. To Alex Surf Club, they'll be so sad to see you go, but there's always time. As my husband says, everything is subject to change. Sometimes the change of guard is good, and also for you to step back and actually perhaps enjoy smelling the roses, taking a bit more time for you and Sheila, your family. But I just want to say thank you, hand on heart, for everything that you give and do. Thank you, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Self Love Podcast. Be sure to write a review and share the love with your friends and family. And head over and visit Kim and her team at 28.com. That's the word 20 and the number 8.com. Take good care.
This has been a production of TheWellnessCouch.com. Check us out on Facebook and join in the conversation on Facebook.com/TheWellnessCouch. Subscribe to each show on iTunes and check us out on Twitter. The Wellness Couch, streaming wellness into your lives.
Whilst the Wellness Couch presenter endeavor to provide accurate and helpful information to their listeners, these podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Wellness Couch podcasts.